Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Dan Margulies, and we are going to be talking about the tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein about whether animals, and in particular, service animals, are permitted inside our holiest sanctums, inside the sanctuary of a shul. Now, Rabbi Dan Margulies is originally from Bethesda, Maryland, and serves on the Judaics faculty of the Berman Hebrew Academy in Rockville, Maryland. He received his BA in chemical physics and mathematics from Columbia University. And I understand that during your smicha studies, you formed a special relationship with Rabbi Simcha Kraus, Zichron Livracha. I know the loss is still in recent memory, and I want to wish you continued nechama. God willing, this learning we're going to do should serve as nachas for him. And in particular, I wanted to highlight that the Margulies family has a registered therapy dog named Menachem, and they work with local...
He passed away. That's an old bio.
Oh, it's an old... Oh, so now I have to continue, Nechama. A lot of recent losses. Do you have a new...
We did get a new dog, though we're not training him this time. It's too much work. Mm. But actually, in part, our experience with volunteering with a therapy animal is part of what inspired my original interest in research into this topic that we'll hopefully get into a little bit soon.
Absolutely, and that's the direction I was going in, which is that when I bring people on to do tshuvos, I've actually pushed away a lot of our guests from doing Igros Moshe. I feel like it's too much of a cop-out, but I actually was matir this one because I know that you're not just providing, first of all, God willing, B'shot Tov U'Mitzlachas, your essay on the topic, which is very well researched, should be published soon. Keep an eye out for that, our listeners. Maybe reach out directly to Rabbi Margulies for it. But also, in addition to the scholarship, you bring the personal experience, which I think is very important for understanding the metzias of this tshuva. So without any further ado, maybe just give us a little bit of background about the notion of a service animal for those of us who aren't as familiar and what context we need. I think our listeners by now are hopefully familiar with Rav Moshe Feinstein. For some reason, you just walked in onto this episode. He was the preeminent posek of 20th century, certainly Ashkenazic, certainly American Orthodoxy, but Rabbi Margulies. So what do we need to know?
In terms of the question of service animals, I think there is a documented history throughout even past several centuries, though scattered sources. The first real professional training programs for service animals for people with disabilities, as far as my research shows, were developed in Germany in the wake of World War I. Many veterans were returning from the war with serious disabilities and injuries. And there was this idea that dogs obviously can be trained for a variety of purposes. You can train a dog to lead someone who's blind, which is one of the first applications. And nowadays, there are many different service animals in use, both dogs, horses, and even other animals that can be used for a variety of assistive needs for people with disabilities, whether that's someone who's blind who needs guidance, how to navigate through their home or through the streets, but also service animals for epilepsy, who can alert when someone's having a seizure, service animals who can assist with mobility or accessing different things around the home for people who have other sorts of disabilities. So really, this is a question that Rav Moshe is going to focus primarily on a case of a seeing eye dog, service dog for someone who's blind. But obviously, there are many other applications nowadays as well. In terms of the metzias, before we get into some of the post-game analysis of this, it's very important to understand that these animals are incredibly well-trained, incredibly professional when they're working. And they don't misbehave. They don't get distracted. They don't make a mess when they're on the job. And their owners and the trainers are very careful about when exactly they're allowed to behave in certain ways and keep them under control appropriately.
Right. I imagine that's an important detail because, I'm not going to lie. I read the tshuva beforehand. I'm also preparing this for my Igros Moshe series with tradition. I imagine some of the opponents of the lenient position are going to raise the issue of the decorum of the shul. But I see you're preempting that already by mentioning that there's a difference between just a stompet versus a professionalized trained service animal.
100%. We're going to see that the central halachic question that Rav Moshe deals with is the question of what's called kalos rosh in the synagogue. So kalos rosh means frivolity, acting in an appropriate way. That's where you would localize this question, presumably. It comes up in Megillah Daf Kaf Chet Amud Aleph. It comes up in the Yerushalmi, as we're going to see a very important discussion there. And Rav Moshe, the question is, number one, assuming that this is a question of kalos rosh, bringing an animal into the synagogue, then under what circumstances would it be permissible? And then at the end of the tshuva, I'm ruining the ending, he basically says, actually, I don't know if this is really a question of kalos rosh. And we'll see that Rav Moshe's sensitivity to the question is one where he's really trying to move the needle on how do we approach the question of disabilities. This tshuva was written in 1953 to Rav Pinchas Teitz in Elizabeth, New Jersey, a prominent posek and major rav in his own right. And the question is written in Shvat. So I can anticipate Rav Moshe mentions the Megillah reading a few times in the tshuva. There's a blind member of the community in Elizabeth. We know Rav Teitz was very active in Kiruv and trying to involve Jews who were not necessarily so close to their Judaism after the Holocaust to stay involved and connected to the Orthodox community. And so I imagine Rav Teitz has this blind person with a service animal in the community, wants to make sure that they can come for Megillah reading on Purim, and he sends the Shaila to Rav Moshe. Can this person attend the synagogue with their service animal? Is that going to be a problem? And so it's right before Purim, and it references Masachas Megillah. It's already a very on topic. Rav Moshe, like I said, the first topic he really brings up is that question of Kalos Rosh, and he references a sugya in the Talmud Yerushalmi and Masachat Megillah, where the various Amoraim are discussing the parameters of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses. How holy is the synagogue, and what can it or can it not be used for? Quote, it's a Braisa. The Braisa says you're not allowed to do Kalos Rosh in the synagogue and gives a few examples. And then the Yerushalmi relates several Amoraim, and particularly Rav Imi, who authorized even someone who's not a big Talmud Chacham, just someone who the Yerushalmi says, meluchlach beoraita, someone who's dirty with Torah, which is such a strange expression,
right,
to stay overnight in the synagogue. We know historical record, we know from archaeology and even certain minhagim, that people used to sleep over in the synagogue. It was a kind of a community house.
Right, that's the idea of like the whole making Kiddush Friday night, that it served as a bit of a social hole as well.
Right.
Now, maybe not to the same extent as in 20th century America, where you had certain people arguing that there should be a pool in every synagogue, but it did serve as a community center as well.
Correct. That may be the origin of the term Beit HaKnesset, a place of gathering. It's not just Beit Tfilah. It's a place where the community comes together. And so he says, if someone comes to you who is dirty with Torah, to have a mekablin lay, accept him to sleep over, ule chamre, and his donkey. And Rav Moshe says, oh, this is perfect evidence for the fact that under the circumstances of someone who is technically a Torah scholar, technically has permission to use the Beit HaKnesset for mundane purposes, they and their animal are permitted to enter. And so that really becomes Rav Moshe's primary source. The fact that the Yerushalmi is cited by the Ran and the Magen Avraham and the later Achronim bolsters his position primarily.
Yeah, I mean, look, the Talmud Yerushalmi is a pretty early source, and seemingly there's no contradiction from the Bavli. Bavli doesn't mention this detail, but it's not contradicted. Of course, I guess one of the questions that this raises is this actually being rendered correctly as donkey? And also, what's very unclear from the Gemara is if the donkey's actually coming physically into right. the Beis HaKnesses, or Beis Medrash, I should say. Or, you know, there could have been a stable that was outside, right. possibly.
So we'll get to the reception history of this tshuva, hopefully, in a little bit. And we'll see that the other poskim disagree with some of Rav Moshe's interpretations there. And then Rav Moshe really has the bulk of the tshuva. He goes on a bit of a tangent for this topic, but of course with far-reaching implications for many halachic circumstances nowadays, which is the question of for what purposes, under what context, does a t'nai work on the construction of the Beit HaKnesset? So the idea is that the synagogues which are built outside the land of Israel, Batei Knesiot Shebechutz La'aretz, are built al t'nai. They're built on condition that they be permissible to use for mundane purposes, and also built on the condition that they will be destroyed at some point in the future, presumably, God willing, as the Jewish people return to the land of Israel. And so the question is, under what circumstances does that work? what does the Tanai work for? And there's a Rav Moshe develops this idea that there's a machloket rishonim. He cites the permissive rishonim, Ramban, Rashba, and the Ran, saying that the Tanai even works when the synagogue is in use. And he cites some more stringent opinions of the rishonim. He cites Rashi and the Hagos Asheri, who seem to say that the Tanai only works when the synagogue is no longer in use as a synagogue. But he tries to build his argument that we could be somech on the lenient position for two reasons. Number one is he claims that obviously to allow a person with disabilities to attend synagogue at all should be considered shad hadchak, should be considered pressing circumstances. And which I think is a fair assumption to make. That is, this person, if they're never allowed to go with their service animal to the synagogue, then they'll never be able to go to the synagogue. It's not as if they have some other option. As we'll see some of
that. Right. I want to actually just read, if I may, I just want to read his language because I think he really drives this point home. He says, first he says that the dog is no worse than a donkey. We could talk about that as well. There's no greater extenuating circumstance than this. If we don't permit him to come in with his service animal, yispatel kol yamav mitfila betzibor ukriyas Torah. Ukriyas HaMegillah, as you mentioned, Bitzibor. He'll never be able to daven. He won't be able to come on the Yom and the Raim either. And so there's, from a religious standpoint, that he's not going to be able to daven with the community and fulfill communal mitzvos. And also he mentions the psychological distress, the agmas nefesh. That's the shas and chak we're dealing with over here.
And he cites the fact that the Ramah, in a somewhat much discussed Minhag as well, references the fact that it causes agmas nefesh, real pain for people to not attend the synagogue on certain times, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, when even there's not necessarily a halachic reason why it's better to go those days than other days, but there's a neshama reason, there's a religious reason.
You know, if only we had that same feeling of agmas nefesh, like every morning for Shacharis.
Right. I think there's a tshuva of the Radbaz where he was asked, if someone has opportunity to get out of prison one day, right? And so the whole question is, well, do you just pick tomorrow so that you can go put on tefillin, so you can go daven with the community? Or do you like davka try to pick Pesach or Rosh Hashanah to hear the shofar or something like that? And again, that's that same question. Every mitzvah that presents its opportunity, you should grab it regardless, or wait till the big ones, you know, wait till the ones that have personal meaning. And then the other piece of Rav Moshe's argument besides Shas Hadchak piece, he quotes the Mishnah Berurah, which for readers of Rav Moshe, is not 100% surprising, but it's definitely not his most common thing, because this is 1953. This is sort of just as the Mishnah Berurah is picking up steam in America as the go-to on Or HaChaim. And Rav Moshe, of course, was not raised or educated in America, so he predates some of that bias toward constantly gravitating to the Mishnah Berurah. And nonetheless, here he quotes the Mishnah Berurah as sort of another reason to be lenient. Oh, the Mishnah Berurah cites it, which is interesting the way he relates to it. Again, the methodological questions about how does Rav Moshe use Achronim in his arguments. And then the other piece is, and this is something I know you mentioned previously, Rabbi Kurtz, on Facebook, Rav Moshe relates to a number of different data points regarding the use of the synagogue in modern times. And he's particularly, let's say, pointing to 20th century America, where, well, the case that we're dealing with, a blind person coming with a service animal, is shat hadchak. It's a time of great necessity. But what about if it's mitzvah ktzat? What if it's a little mitzvah, like to have sudat shlishit in the synagogue, or a torech gadol, a great need? And then he references, well, what about a bar mitzvah party or a ufruf in the synagogue, where he says there's not even really an inyan mitzvah even at all. That's just a celebration. And then he talks about the Hasidim have the practice to eat in the synagogue for Devar HaRishut, even something optional, like for a yard site. So he...
Which I feel like that's a little bit of a poke at the Hasidim, because the original, correct me if I'm wrong, the original Ashkenazic minhag was actually to fast on a yard site. And then they turned it dafka, you know, like now it's a mitzvah to eat and drink on the yard site. So I feel like that's like a little bit of a poke over there.
It's a little poke at the Hasidim for sure. And the classic example in the Gemara, in Megillah, of what counts as Kalut Rosh in the synagogue is Ein Ochlin V'Shotin Bahem. You're not allowed to eat and drink in the synagogue. And yet we know it's very common for many smaller synagogues, especially, you know, Shtiblach and things like this, to bring out Kiddush into the main synagogue space, to serve cookies and crackers, to have Shalshutis in the synagogue space.
And we're talking about, like, Mamish literally within the sanctuary proper, right. Not like exactly. A social hall. I know he has a tshuva where he talks about, can you play cards and bingo in a social hall? And he's like, yeah, technically you're allowed to, but it's a davar mechuar, I think he describes right. as, which I'm like, I mean, if cards and bingo is the worst thing we do.
Well, you should ask Rav Willig about what he thinks about the bingo. He has a good story about that.
I know you learned in the Kol HaYoyi for a little bit, so you've had some interaction.
Yes. Yeah. One of Rav Willig's early rabbinic psakim he gave for the Young Israel Riverdale to not allow a bingo as a fundraiser.
If any of the seniors from my shul are listening, cover your ears at this. you can forget you heard that.
And then at the end of this sort of central long section of the Tshuva, Rav Moshe gets into a point which, again, in terms of methodology and Rav Moshe's style, becomes crucial. So he's addressing this question of, oh, nowadays in the 20th century, everybody is lenient about eating in the synagogue. And he quotes a Rashi from Masechet Shabbat on Daf Yud, which you're like, well, what's going on here? And the topic of this Rashi is whether or not the halacha nowadays is to give the portions of a kosher slaughtered animal to the kohen or not, the cheeks, the leg, and the stomach, which, okay, well, what's the issue there? And Rav Moshe has, not Rav Moshe, Rashi has this very powerful line at the end where he's sort of discussing the evolution of practice. The Gemara quotes one opinion, the Gemara quotes a different opinion. It seems that the Gemara seems conclusive in the direction of we should give this to the Kohanim nowadays. That's how the Rambam paskins, that's how the Shulchan Aruch paskins. The Rashi didn't know that. but Rav Moshe did. And Rashi at the end says, V'chihechi da'achazu b'minhag, b'reishit hagez, now that the custom is to not give reishit hagez anymore, the first shearings of the sheep to the Kohen, which is a mitzvah d'oraisa. And he says, V'lo machina b'hu, the Amoraim didn't object to the dropping off of that practice. Since the current practice is to be lenient regarding these gifts to the Kohanim, we're not going to change the minhag either. And Rav Moshe makes this claim that this Rashi is like a crucial source for understanding we have to hold fast to the minhag. Now that the minhag is more lenient, we're not going to budge from that.
This is really just like a crazy throwaway paragraph in here. I feel like whenever I hear people discuss this tshuva, and I appreciate that you did this, by the way, they jump to all of the relevant sources for dogs in particular. But this is actually the most, you know, this has the widest implications. Forget about the dogs. This whole idea that Rav Moshe says, oh yeah, there's like a Rashi over here that says that minna can change even when it's negative what everyone was doing before. And especially given, I don't remember all the citations offhand, but there's many tshuvos where Rav Moshe really stands up for the integrity of minhagim. He thought minhag was really important. And then here he says, yeah, we could see chassidim are eating food in the shtiebel at a yard site. I guess the minhag changed based on this Rashi on Shas. It's just, it really blows my mind.
He's willing to endorse the Hasidic practice because the minhag has changed to be more lenient, and we're okay with that. We're going to continue following the new minhag to be lenient. So one of my teachers, Rabbi Yehuda Sussman, who's the Rosh Hashiva at Eretz Tzvi in Israel, he wrote his master's thesis on methodology of Rav Moshe, and he has some whole section in his thesis about this paragraph of this tshuva dealing with how does Rav Moshe use this Rashi. And I think he has citations to the Dibros Moshe as well. I'll have to go double check. You know, the academic side of it is not my expertise, but consult with Mori Varabi at some point if you'd like to hear his take on Rav Moshe as well. Obviously a big expert in the field. So that's basically the big piece of Rav Moshe's argument, which is number one, the Yerushalmi says you can bring an animal into the synagogue. Number two, our synagogues in Chutz La'aretz at least are built al Tanai, and we know that Tanai, the current practice, is to follow the most lenient interpretation of how that Tanai works. You're permitted to do whatever you want in the synagogue since our synagogues, we don't really treat them with Kedusha anyway, which feels kind of like a sad conclusion to come to, but of course is very practical, which is that we actually don't need to treat the modern synagogue in Chutz La'aretz at least with so much reverence and kedusha. We can use it as a social hall, as other kinds of space as needed. And therefore bringing a dog in, if it's a problem of Kalus Rosh, is not a problem. Mm-hmm. At the end, he does a thing which I think Rav Moshe does quite a bit, though I haven't done the encyclopedic research to find out, where he sort of shows his cards at the end and he says, really, maybe this isn't actually Kalus Rosh. Maybe, and this is something that in my research I found, you know, Rishonim and Achronim who discuss, the definition of Kalus Rosh can't be that it means you're acting inappropriately, you're acting frivolously. This is a person who's coming to synagogue to do the mitzvot, and they have a service animal with them. That's not frivolity. That's not
inappropriate. It's tefillah.
It's letzorech tefillah. It's for the purpose of facilitating this person's participation in the community, for the purpose of inclusion and accommodation. And so Rav Moshe says, that's not Kalos Rosh. There's a Mordechai. I think I forget which masachet the Mordechai is in. The Mordechai says, there's a similar halacha. You're not allowed to act with Kalos Rosh in a Beis HaKvaros, in a cemetery.
Hmm.
But he says, anything that's being done for medical purposes, for some refuah, isn't Kalos Rosh. That's what the Mordechai says. So again, I think that's a valuable precedent for understanding where Moshe is coming from, which is like, okay, just because Bechefza, this is a dog, doesn't mean that we have to relate to it halachically as a dog. This is what this person needs to come to shul. Just like if a person has a physical disability that they need a wheelchair or a cane or a hearing aid, we have accommodations and we understand the need for that person to attend synagogue regardless, even if in some way it's going to be disruptive or distracting to other people. So too, Rav Moshe says, bringing the dog is not going to be a problem.
Right. I understand that was your chiddush at the end of your drafted article. I took a look at it, which was saying that we're looking at the dog as this separate entity, but we should really see him as an extension of the body of this individual, similar to other tools that someone who has a handicap would utilize.
Right. And that's something that comes out of how the Aruch HaShulchan in Siman Shin Aleph in Orchaim cites the Rush about a person walking with a cane on Shabbat, questions of carrying. Other Achronim, there's a whole pilpul in the Chazon Ish that I have for another time when we have more time to discuss. But I wanted to get to the reception history and the poskim who disagree with Rav Moshe, because I think it's fascinating that to many of us, our bias is, oh, Rav Moshe said it, kvar hora zakein. You know, we have a great posek who already endorsed a lenient position, authorized this accommodation for people with disabilities. A great number of poskim disagreed, both Ashkenazi and Sephardi, European, American, Israeli. So just to give you a list of some of them, the Chalkas Yaakov, that's Rav Mordechai Breisch in Zurich, writing in the 20th century. We have Menachem Mendel Kasher, the editor of Torah Shlema, but was himself also a posek, involved with a number of serious halachic issues, writing in 20th century in Israel. He had a correspondence with the Lubavitcher Rebbe on this. There's a back and forth in the Chuvos Shama Shlomo from Rav Shlomo Amar, where he corresponds with Yemenite Dayan Rav Azariah Bessis in Israel, where Rav Bessis basically says, yeah, I think it's totally prohibited, and he disagrees with Rav Moshe's arguments, and he says, it doesn't mean he brought the donkey into the synagogue. The donkey must have been outside, or it means donkey driver, because we know that the difference between Chamrei and Chamarei, right, is it his donkey or his donkey men?
And I think some, it was a Rav Abadi who says it might be rendered wine, possibly.
Right. Chamrei also maybe could mean wine. Chamar in Aramaic means wine. So many of these Sephardi poskim in particular, Rav Bessis, Rav Amar, Rav Yitzchak Abadi, in his Or Yitzchak, respond to Rav Moshe either by claiming, oh, he's reading the Yerushalmi wrong. Interestingly, Rav Amar actually thinks that Rav Moshe reads the Yerushalmi correctly, but he thinks it's an exaggeration, or he thinks it's not necessarily Lamasa. And so I think it's fascinating both historically and culturally to think about, number one, why is it that in the late 20th century, maybe 20, 30, 40 years after Rav Moshe published, is this still a live issue in Israel for Sephardi poskim? And why is it in particular maybe the Sephardim who have a certain stronger aversion to dogs in the synagogue? A lot of references to like this fear that the dog is going to make a waste in the synagogue and things like that.
But that's what's so interesting is that Rav Moshe in his analysis says, this heter is for chutz la'aretz. Maybe it works for shuls in Eretz Yisrael. So it's not even like he's encroaching on the jurisdiction of the rabbis in Eretz Yisrael. Yet they seem to still be taking maybe their Baal Batim or coming over and saying, hey, this rabbi from America said we could do it. Why can't you be matur? If the Ashkenazim could do it, why can't us Sephardim, right?
Right. And I wonder if it's also something to do with maybe at what point service animals were adopted in the Israeli culture, like thinking about people who maybe were veterans or injured in the Yom Kippur War or in the Lebanon War. I know that in the Lebanon War in the 80s, the Israeli army started using bomb-smelling dogs and things like that more frequently. So it may be that there was a hesitancy in Middle Eastern culture, Muslim culture, as well as Sephardi Jewish culture to dogs for at least the past few centuries. And there's a fear in Muslim culture. There's a lot of concern that dogs are haram. And so it may be that there's a stronger cultural aversion to this. And the American Ashkenazi community, sort of influenced by American pet culture, maybe have less discomfort. And so that's biasing the way they read certain halachic sources, perhaps.
Yeah, and that's what I noticed. I took a look at Mesoras Moshe, which of course is not Rav Moshe directly. It's his posterity. I think it was Rav Mordechai Tendler, if I'm not mistaken, who wrote it or collected along with other family members. And there's like questions are asked Rav Moshe about what do I do with my dog on Pesach if I'm giving him to, you know, a non-Jew to watch? What do I do if he has a tag? Is that an issue of the animal doing Hotzah on Shabbos? And so in all these different responses that Rav Moshe gives, what I thought was noteworthy was what was missing from there. In none of those responses did he decide to get on a soapbox and editorialize about, wait, but why do you own a dog in the first place? Which you'll see, like, he'll do that for other things. He just took it as reality that people had pets, which I find fascinating because I grew up in more of like kind of the black hat world. And in yeshivish community, I mean, maybe it's because, you know, you want to put all your finances into Period of Rivia and, you know, having more children. But the notion of like a from Yid owning a dog is just like, it's pasnish. Like that's not right. Something that's done.
I think some of that may be that the fear, and you see this in the Chalkas Yaakov with Rav Breisch writing soon after the Holocaust. There's a fear in certain Ashkenazi community, perhaps that all dogs are Nazis.
Yes, I've heard those stories.
Right, that people who were survivors obviously knew that the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, used dogs for enforcement and policing and to scare Jews in the ghettos and things like that. So obviously there's
a trauma that's still within the consciousness.
Even from before the Shoah as well, that in Europe, you know, who was it who owned dogs? Though I imagine Jews who were more in rural communities often would have had dogs for shepherding or guard dogs and things like that. And there's discussion of that in Gemara and Rishonim as well. So it's not as, and in the Torah, right? Le'echaratz kelev l'shono. So it's not as if there are.
But it's also Mechir kelev, the issue of Mechir kelev.
Right? So that's what Rav Kasher cites. But I think it's so strange. Rav Kasher cites the halacha of Mechir kelev that you're not allowed to bring the money that you used when you sold your dog to buy a korban. And he says, oh, so of course you can't bring a dog to shul. But the halakha, actually, I think it's a Mishnah in Tmura, I think. I'm forgetting which Masach. Maybe it's Me'ila. Says, Mechir kelev velo kelev atzmo. Esnan zona velo zona atzma. So there's actually no prohibition on a dog, per se. There's a prohibition on Mechir kelev. Anyway, that's a whole other shear for a whole other time.
Right, and so just circling back to the reception. So what I gather is there's kind of like the disagreement on a technical level, that there are those who disagree with the technicalities of how to read the Gemara, and then there are those who accept Rav Moshe's rendering and reading of the Gemara, but then they disagree on its application on a more fundamental level. And I know you mentioned the Minchas Yitzchak. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the Minchas Yitzchak has a lot of those, and also Rav Shlomo Amar has a number of those, where like Rav Amar makes this claim, oh, actually, dogs are much more disgusting than donkeys. Donkeys are an animal of great prestige in Jewish tradition, and dogs are not. You know, Yosef's brothers traveled with donkeys, and all the Maraim and Tanaim had donkeys, so it's very prestigious. And Rav Breisch talks about, you know, again, this concerns that the animals are going to bark and scare children, that the Gemara talks about a dog barking and a woman, Rahman al-Islam, having a miscarriage. And so, again, the sort of broader cultural fears and concerns there really seep through it. And for someone, you know, a posek, you get a different style. Rav Moshe's writing, in this tshuva at least, is very technical and very matter of fact. And Rav Breisch's writing reads as super polemical on the issue. He really quotes a lot of broader meta-halachic questions, much more beyond than just, does this Yerushalmi permit it or not?
Right. At the end of that tshuva, I mean, I don't have the lashon in front of me right now, but, you know, it left an indelible impression upon me. First of all, he invokes the general slippery slope argument. He says also, not only are we going to serve as a bad example for others, but we are being porates geder ourselves inside. Right. You know, he transliterates the word rabbi instead of rab, like Ramosha does, but he says, yes, some rabbi over there is going to say, ah, you see all those from people under Rav Moshe's psak, they were matir, bring a dog in for a shas and chak. Okay, so they're the prushim, they're the really from people. So that means we could also do it for non-shas and chak.
And the other thing he's worried about is he says it's going to cause chil Hashem gadol shehanotzrim osrim lehachnis kelev lebeis tefilasam. That Christians don't permit this either. Which again, I think the metzius has changed. I think again, if a blind person would come to a blind Christian will go to their church with a service dog, I think most churches would allow this.
That's an interesting question. You know, like, you know, also, is it like the more progressive churches, the firmer churches, the Catholic churches?
I don't think so. I think nowadays, now 70 years later, almost, this has just become a thing. This, the ADA is passed. Obviously, religious institutions, perhaps unfortunately, have ADA exemption. But our cultural understanding of people with disabilities is these are people. This is how they get around. This is what they need. You can't ask them to leave it outside. This is just part of them. They go as a team. And Rav Breish at the end, you know, he's so harif, and the conclusion comes so different, because Rav Moshe's claim was, this is a shas hadchak, this person is not going to be able to do mitzvot, it's going to cause agbas nefesh. And Rav Breish says, maybe suma pater min a mitzvot. Maybe you're blind, so you're pater from all the mitzvot. And it's like,
oh, that's not the premise.
Write that in this tshuva.
Right. It's okay. I'll just clarify. I thought you were getting to a different point. The part that I was very excited about was where he quotes Rav Moshe's own Hakdama against him. And he's like, you know, I thought that there was a certain rabbi who wrote in his Hakdama to Rav Moshe about being really careful and deliberate before poskening something with very wide implications. Yes. And that's just like a gut punch. You know what I would expect that from? I would expect that from the Mana Le'Igros, which, by the way, I checked up. There is a Mana Le'Igros on this. The Mana Le'Igros, you know, with all of his chutzpah dik lashonos, he does make valid points. And that's why Rav Avadi and others will actually quote him with a caveat.
Right.
So the Mana Le'Igros says, you know, I don't get metzias wise how it's a shas adchak. Presumably, there's some good, you know, I don't say good Samaritans, it's a Christian Bible, but there's some good people, a good few men who are there at the shul, or women, if she's a woman coming in, and they could help the person in and leave the dog in the lobby or outside. So metzias-wise, is this really the shas and chak their emotions making it out to be?
And the answer to that is to understand the metzias again. Many of the poskim seem to recommend, just leave the dog tied up outside and a person will escort this blind person into the synagogue. That's not how a service dog works. The service dog has to be trained together with the person it's servicing. They have to stay together, because otherwise the dog will be nervous about the person. The dog, like, there's so many pieces of how it works as an assistive technology. That it seems like many of those poskim unfortunately didn't understand the full metzias of. And I think, you know, in terms of the modern writing that's come out on this, like, I know Rav Benny Lau in Israel wrote a large pamphlet discussing this, and some other Rav Chaim Jachter has something he wrote up for about his synagogue in New Jersey, where anyone with a real life contemporary understanding of the situation understands that the only solution is to allow the person into the synagogue. And the question then is, what's the hetzer? And I know we feel uncomfortable saying that in questions of psak, because we don't like feeling like our hands are tied. But if the only other answer is that this person can never come to shul, like, you're doing something wrong in halacha. And I think Rav Moshe knew that. And I think that's what Rav Moshe says. This isn't kalos rosh. This is letzorech hatfila. This is just how this person gets around. And once you're thinking of it that way, it solves all the problems. And obviously there's a lot more to be said about this topic. You know, I've written a few pages long article about it. There are other arguments to make in defense of the practice, but the courage and the ingenuity of Rav Moshe, number one, to have the Yerushalmi at his fingertips. Number two, in 1953, to have the foresight and the vision, Chacham Eina Birosho, to know, Chacham Roes HaNolad, to know that this is going to be a major change in how people with disabilities are accommodated in public space, and to find a heter for it is so Rav Moshe, and it brings a smile to my face. And to take the Rav Moshe's religious leadership in that regard, that he sees, I'm going to write a letter to Rav Teitz and tell him that this is okay, and to make sure that this person can hear Megillah, and to make sure that this sets a precedent, at least for the American community, that this is how we make sure our synagogues are open to everyone who needs to come.
I think that's a really important point. It speaks to the guidance of Rav Moshe. And it also, I appreciate you bringing in the Metzias, which I didn't appreciate that. I was reading the reception history, the literature, criticizing Moshe, like how could it not a curter of Moshe leave the dog outside? And then you come along and say, no, Rav Moshe actually probably understood the Metzias so much to the extent that that wasn't even a Havamina. So regardless, I always say it's important that when people come on the podcast, they share something more that the listener could get than reading the tshuva themselves. I've certainly gotten something from this more than I would have gotten had I read it just myself like I did. So I also wanted to mention that I was going to say this in the introduction, that I have to be Makar Tov. I think Rabbi Margolis is one of the people who makes me rationalize that all my time on social media is not necessarily Bittul Torah. To all of our listeners, you should check him out on Twitter and various platforms.
I've been on Twitter now over a year. But
okay. Well, you know what? I should learn from you, perhaps.
We'll build off of that because it's a lesson we learned from Rav Teitz. Pinchas Teitz was the first one to teach Gemara over the radio. He had a Motzi Shabbos shir on the radio in Yiddish teaching Gemara. And for the 1 year anniversary, when he celebrated the 1 year anniversary of his radio show, many great Gedolim came and spoke out. And I think it may have been Rav Kasher even who spoke at the reception and said, it may have been for this reason that the radio was invented. That is to understand that the power of new technologies to share Torah, to bring people together, right? If social media is for schmoozing, then we should make sure that as much of the schmoozing as possible should be about learning Torah and teaching Torah, and to take inspiration from Rav Teitz, who is an incredible communal leader and the posek in his own right, and incredible melamed to so many Jews after the Shoah. Of course, you know, to consult with Rav Moshe on major question like this is incredible. And whenever new technology and new medium comes along, the podcasts as well, we have to make sure we infuse them with as much Torah learning as possible. And Rabbi Kurtz is someone who makes me always feel very self-conscious because he's incredibly productive, incredibly prolific, and generating so much Torah for the world. It's wonderful to learn with you and read with you. So,
well, amen. And God willing, we should have many more occasions to learn together in the future.
Amen.
And, you know, yeah, this is a kiyum of the legacy that you just outlined. I hope that we should be mekayim through this session and God willing, many more to come. Yashar Koach, Rabbi Dan Margolis, and take care.
Thank you. Good.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.